welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington, D.C. Sierra Leone's President Julius Maada Bio begins his second five-year term.
I want to use this opportunity on behalf of His Excellency to congratulate Sierra Leoneans for treating the civic responsibility of going out there to vote.
The European Union Election Observation Mission releases its final report about Nigeria's recent general election.
One of the issues they advocated, some of the things we have been complaining about post-election, issues around, because the report talked about the poor arrangement by the electoral management body, the INEC.
And South African opposition figure calls on the African National Congress, or ANC, to pressure Zimbabwe to ensure the coming elections are credible.
The truth of the matter is that ZANU-PF are trading in a coalition with the ANC as former liberators, and ZANU-PF now have become oppressors of the people of Zimbabwe.
Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. President Julius Maada Bio has begun his second five-year term. This after he was declared winner of last week's presidential election. But the main opposition All People's Congress, or APC party, rejected the outcome of the poll, citing voter irregularities and rigging. The party also accused the police of intimidation and harassment of its supporters during the elections. Sierra Leoneans went to the polls last week to choose a new president, mayors, and local representatives. Mohamed Rahman Soare is Sierra Leone's information minister. He tells me that voters maintained confidence in President Maada Bio's leadership, which he says significantly contributed to the incumbent first-round victory.
I want to use this opportunity on behalf of His Excellency to congratulate Sierra Leoneans for treating the civic responsibility of going out there to vote, and he had enjoined them to ensure that they did all of that safely, meaning peacefully. I want, on behalf of myself and my family, and indeed on behalf of government, to congratulate His Excellency for a resounding fourth-round victory. Wishing him all the best in the second term.
The opposition claims that the elections were rigged and that it does not reflect the will of the Sierra Leonean.
They lack merit for many reasons. In the first place, His Excellency announced the elections calendar over a year in advance, in March last year. So which means all political parties had enough time to align their internal party dynamics and prepare for the elections. The APC was busy with internal bickerings. They were busy with leadership struggles and, you know, did not have a real time to campaign and campaign with a message that will resonate with the people. Whereas His Excellency President Bio gave his all. He took his best shot at this campaign. He went to every nook and cranny of the country, and he had a record to run on. That's the whole point. So I don't see, and no Sierra Leonean can understand how the APC could have claimed to win an election like this, right?
What should the people of Sierra Leone expect from President Bio's second term presidency?
Well, so His Excellency, immediately after the official announcement of the results by the ECSL, laid out his vision for the country. After thanking, you know, the various salient stakeholders for having afforded him an opportunity and his party for a second inning, he laid out his plan. One, he wants to provide food security for Sierra Leone. We recognize hunger has been a perennial feature of Sierra Leone. In 2018, we are the third hungriest nation in the world. Today, we are the ninth hungriest nation in the world. We are not satisfied with that. His Excellency has committed himself to ensuring that he feeds Sierra Leone. And to take that forward, he's already secured the Food Compact from the African Development Bank, whose leadership has promised to accompany him every inch of the way. Apart from that, he's committed to create jobs for 500,000 youths in the next 5 years, which means every year he'll be able to create 500,000 jobs. And nobody has any reason to doubt that.
One of the major criticisms against the president during the campaigns was that Sierra Leone is divided on ethnic lines, and that a lot of his ethnic people were put in higher positions, neglecting the other tribes, so to speak. What is your reaction to this?
That's a baseless claim. I mean, this president, more than anybody else, has been the biggest investor in a united, peaceful, and progressive Sierra Leone. I mean, just to demonstrate that, in 1996, he was the person who first appointed Dr. Samora Camara to government as Minister of Finance. A tribalist could have looked for his kinsmen, right? He didn't. He looked for somebody who, in his opinion, was up to the task. He gave him the opportunity. Again, since the Civil War ended in 2002, there was a recommendation for the establishment of an independent commission for peace. No Sierra Leonean president has ever done that. It's under his presidency's leadership that recommendation has been taken to fruition. Today, you now have a robust institution to midwife peace and to draw the attention of government to early warning signs. So this is to his credit. Over and above that, President Bio has appointed people to positions of trust from across the country. Ministers of Defense, for example, are normally and usually, you know, from the president's tribesmen. President Bio has gone beyond that. He's looked for the best Sierra Leoneans to appoint to positions of trust. And you talk about the opposition saying they are best fitted to unite this country. I don't see how that can happen, because at their last convention, they appointed about 95% all Northerners. When it comes to issues of national unity and cohesion, President Bio is the guy. He is the man who can unite this country, and he has pledged in his acceptance speech to continue to be president for all Sierra Leone, and he has extended a hand of friendship and fellowship to all progressive political leaders, including Dr. Samora Camara, to join him in the arduous task of building a progressive, united, and prosperous Sierra Leone for every Sierra Leonean.
Mohamed Rahman Soare is Sierra Leone's information minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. The majority of Malians has welcomed the decision of the UN Security Council to end its peacekeeping mission in the country Friday. Salif Tigana, a Malian who is the CEO of Tigana Technology, a tech company based in the capital Bamako, says most citizens back calls by the military junta for the UN mission to leave the country. In a unanimous vote, the UN Security Council ended the mandate of the United Nations Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission in Mali, better known as MINUSMA. Human rights groups, however, say the decision to withdraw the peacekeepers will negatively impact the monitoring of Islamic extremists and the protection of unarmed civilians. For more reaction from Mali about the UN Security Council's vote, I reach Salif Tigana.
Well, so far, all the reactions that I have seen are positive. A lot of Malians are expressing their happiness about this news. Because for the majority of Malians, we think there is a clear and good strategy behind all this action taken by the transitional authority. And also because the transitional government benefits a huge presumption of good faith. And it's something like, we believe you and we follow you wherever you go.
The UN mission in Mali, do people see it as a successful mission?
Not at all. That is exactly the problem, where the problem lies. Actually, the majority of Malians are disappointed because the UN peacekeeping forces has not been successful. Also, we have noticed that the Malian government have asked in several occasions the United Nations to reform the peacekeeping forces because we don't see it fit the needs of the Malian people. In security front, it doesn't fit our need. So that's a disappointment, and that's the reason why I think most of people today put their confidence on the traditional government and accompany it, whatever it does, and agree with them on the United Nations keeping forces departure from Mali.
Some people are saying that the withdrawal of the troops will serve as a significant boost to Wagner group in Mali. How are paramilitary groups seen in Mali?
Okay, first of all, I think the problem with the UN have started long way before even French left Mali. So, and that time the Russian was not in Mali. So it's going to be hard to say that the disappointment of Malian people toward the United Nations keeping forces is due to the presence of any international other groups other than UN. And secondly, for most of Malian, they stand with the official narrative, which is that we have a cooperation with Russian Federation, and we have trainers, and we have instructors, but we don't have Wagner. So most of Malian, if you ask them, they will answer you by saying that we don't have Wagner, we have Russian.
Do people in Mali think that they would rather have the Russians in Mali helping with security rather than the UN mission?
Well, as I said earlier, that the majority of Malian are happy with UN departure, but also there are some other Malians that express their concern about this situation. And mostly are people from the north, and also some people that are employed by the UN contractors, Malian contractors. Those people have expressed their concern. But in the majority, the Malian will tell you that we all have seen the cooperation with the French, how that played out. And for several decades now, we have seen the UN peacekeeping forces in Mali, and we have not seen anything significant through their presence in Mali. And now, with the cooperation with the Federation of Russia, people will tell you that since that cooperation started, Mali army has increased its capacity, and it has increased its presence on the ground. And also the mobility, they can go now wherever they wanted. They have more equipment. They have more surveillance equipment to monitor the terrorists, wherever they are. So in that case, in that area, the Malian would told you that the cooperation with the Russian Federation is more important than with UN cooperation.
Salif Tigana is the CEO of Tigana Technology, a tech company. He spoke with me from the capital, Bamako.
Has social media improved your life, or is it more of a distraction? We'd love to hear from you. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. The number again, +1 202-258-3076. Can't wait to hear from you.
In Nigeria, the European Union Election Observation Mission says the Independent National Electoral Commission, or INEC, did not administer a well-run, transparent, and inclusive democratic process as promised. The opinion was contained in the mission's final report it released this week. It calls for legal and operational reforms to help ensure transparency, accountability, and inclusivity. This after some Nigerians say they have lost trust in INEC's ability to organize credible elections. The electoral body declared Asiwa Jubola Ahmed Tinubu, candidate of the ruling All Progressives Congress, or APC, winner of the presidential vote. But this has been disputed and challenged in court. Citing voter irregularities and rigging, former Vice President Atiku Abubakar and former Anambra State Governor Peter Obi say they won the presidential poll. For more reaction to the EU poll observer's final report, I reached Ibrahim Momo. He is a political analyst based in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Nigerians are not really surprised because some of the issues they advocated are some of the things we have been complaining about post-election. Issues around, because the report talked about the poor arrangement by the electoral management body, the INEC, amongst others. So Nigerians have been complaining that the results did not truly reflect a kind of transparency, because INEC promised to upload results in real time, you know, to the server, dedicated server. It's called the IREV for result gene portal. But they didn't do that, at least on the day of the elections. They overpromised and underdelivered. So the reports by EU Election Monitoring Committee tended to align with what a lot of people already have in mind.
The report emphasized that there's need for reforms to enhance transparency and accountability in future elections. Now, this is not the first time an election observer group has released similar report calling for reforms to enhance transparency and accountability in future elections. Do you think this will happen anytime soon? Because a lot of Nigerians have complained.
I think that it has been a work in progress. It's just that this ought to have been a watershed in terms of election transparency. But it appears the election management body fell short of the level of transparency it had promised. It went during this democratic experience in Nigeria since 1990, you did. It had to, there used to be issues of ballot box snatching, ballot box stuffing, you know, outright rigging of elections. And those results will be announced, the results will be taken. But we have moved from that to where people are now buying votes. At a point in time, when it's a case of violence at the polling unit, results are now cancelled. So, and then INEC introduced what they call the permanent voters card, which had a microchip, a kind of electronic voting.
I remember the INEC spokesperson saying that a glitch in the system caused the delay of uploading the presidential election results, although several weeks after the outcome was declared, particularly in the presidential election, 100% of the data has yet to be uploaded. In the future, what do you think INEC can do in order to instill confidence briefly in the people of Nigeria so they will come out to vote?
I think INEC has one basic responsibility, which is to ensure that they follow through on their reforms. You pointed out correctly that they promised to upload results to the dedicated portal in real time. And they claimed that there was a glitch. But during the election petition tribunal, one of the political parties, the Labour Party, brought in somebody that was said to be among the service provider who claimed that there was no service glitch on the day of the election. So there's between, and then when you now look at the fact that let's assume there was a glitch, a week, a month or so after the election, even after swearing in of the candidates who won the election, the result has still not been fully uploaded. It shows that there's some kind of weakness on the part of INEC in terms of following through on the reforms, electoral reforms that they pledged to do. So I think what I would recommend, not just for INEC, but even the Nigerian government, is that in appointing a team to manage our elections, we must ensure that we put persons who are competent and capable at election management, people who have experience in the area of election management, to actually handle election processes in Nigeria. That's a way I think we can get around this challenge.
Ibrahim Momo is a political analyst. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Thank you.
In Ivory Coast, the Minister for the Promotion of Sports and the Development of the Sports Economy says the country has stepped up preparations to host the African Nations Cup next year. Paula Daho says President Alassane Ouattara has been meeting CAF officials and all stakeholders as part of his commitment to sports in the West African country. The minister also says the administration is implementing mechanisms in addition to improving infrastructure to help ensure a successful tournament. In part one of this exclusive interview, Minister Paula Daho details plans and activities underway for the African Nations Cup.
Cote d'Ivoire is fully prepared to host this tournament. The government has invested a massive amount of $1 billion towards upgrading our sport infrastructure, accommodations, hospitals, airports, and roads across the country. This investment is not only in our economical capital, but extends other areas, such as North Region in Korogo, Bikke Region in Bouaké, our political capital, Yamoussoukro, and the primary cocoa spots of San Pedro. Additionally, we created 6 outstanding stadiums and 24 training fields that meet FIFA standards. The fields will then stay within schools, promoting sports for future generations. We are very proud to host this event. And we are ready to show off all the work we are putting for this incoming tournament.
What would you say is the specific mechanisms that Cote d'Ivoire has put in place to ensure a successful tournament?
Well, we put in place several specific mechanisms to ensure that tournament is a success. First and foremost, we have taken all necessary measures to ensure the safety, the peace, the tranquility of all visitors during this event. We want everyone to come and to discover our country, our beautiful country, for tourism and culture, to be comfortable. We want to show you the great and best experience visiting Ivory Coast. Our President, His Excellency Alassane Ouattara, meets personally with all the federation, the boss of the federation, the Confederation of African Football Staff, to express them that we are very ready and we are proud to put a lot of investment to receive all the visitors. And the Prime Minister and me, myself, we are also strong leadership and involvement in all this project.
What's your vision for the sports sector in Cote d'Ivoire?
For us, sports represents a source of creation, well-being, and social cohesion. You know that we have the troubled past in my country. So sports serve as like cement to bring people together beyond their ethnicities, religions, and political beliefs. It unifies and channels the passion of young. So is a social dimension to consider. We want sport to contribute to improve the health and well-being of the population. Additionally, the economical impact of sport is critical for us. In fact, our ministry was before changed the name. And the name was the Ministry of Sports Promotion and Sports Economic Development. It's essential for us to promote sports, also to have a sport-like industry and economy. We have a lot of young people. You know that our people are very young. So you're actually seeking opportunity for young people. You want sport to provide employment, to provide opportunities. So you have to professionalize it as sports effectively. Currently, you know, sports talent are identified and exported to Europe, which means that we're selling muscle. We want them now to be in the country to contribute to creating add value so they can stay in our country. We want sport to be now source of wealth creation, job opportunities to develop very benefic for them to taking a sport like job, not to sell them Europe, to sell them. They want them to stay in our country so young people can benefit from sports economic inside of being exporting abroad.
Paula Adanho is Ivory Coast Minister for the Promotion of Sports and the Development of the Sports Economy. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Abidjan. Join us tomorrow for the conclusion of the conversation. Zimbabweans go to the polls in August to choose a new president and National Assembly. Analysts say President Emmerson Mnangagwa faces a tough challenge from Nelson Chamisa, the leader of the newly formed Citizens Coalition for Change. Local media reports say Chamisa, a former minister for information and technology, is attracting support from the country's youth. This, as opposition groups express concern about intimidation and harassment of their supporters by state institutions, including the police and the judiciary, accusations supporters of the ruling ZANU-PF party sharply rejected. Tyson Savior Kasukuwere is a presidential candidate and a former minister in the governing ZANU-PF party. He tells me that he is the best place to solve the challenges Zimbabweans face, in spite of criticisms that he was part of the problem.
I think I possess the qualities at this hour that are required to get this giant back on its feet again. I possess the political ability to navigate the difficult political terrain in our country. I have the economic managerial skills to be able to help Zimbabwe steer back on an economic path of growth. I also have a very strong social belief that we've got to renew our social contract with our people. So I come from a very strong background in the civil service. I was the minister before, Minister of Youth Development, Indigenization, and Economic Empowerment. I also served as Minister of Environment and Climate, Water. I also served as Minister of Local Government, but I was also the Chief Party Organizer, National Commissar, meaning that I have accumulated a world of experience.
What do you say to your critics who say you were part of the system that created the mess Zimbabweans find themselves now? So why do you all of a sudden think you are the savior, so to speak, by your name, to rescue them from the mess that you contributed?
I'm the one who understands the mistakes. Now, if somebody has never made a mistake, then they're too bad to give an opportunity. It is those who have gone through the mill, who have seen the mistakes, who have seen the other side, who are able to stand up like I have said and say, no, we have a mess. We need to fix this mess. We need our country out of this quagmire. And because I understand exactly where the pain is, I understand exactly where the pots are, I understand exactly where the pans are, I also understand where the forks and knives are in the house.
About the issue of corruption, recently Zimbabweans have complained about endemic corruption in public institutions and in other places, even in private institutions. Give me specific steps you are going to take in order to address the issues of corruption in Zimbabwe.
First and foremostly, you want a government itself that respects the rule of law. You want a leadership that is above the parapet. You want a leadership that is also conscious of their duty and responsibility. Fourthly, you also want to be able to carry with you the country in a determined fight against corruption. Now, these four are going to be determined by how our people vote on the 23rd of August. If they give me the mandate, then they have placed their future in the most safest pair of hands. I will discharge the fight against corruption in a judicious, fair, and very thorough way. Now, the last exposés that we've seen and the kind of non-response by the Zimbabweans is an indication of a punch-drunk nation. a nation which does not know how best to resolve some of these problems. Corruption is mentioned, no investigations are carried out. People are named and nothing happens. And that can't continue. Hence, I have said, I'll stand up. We need to get to the bottom of this corruption. We need at the same time to fight the twin challenge of sanctions, which has given the corrupt cartels a convenient excuse to get involved in these shenanigans that affect the lives of our people. The blood of our people is being sucked by a few vampires. We need to stop that. And the way we're going to do that is by ensuring that we have a clean government, which is going to be built out of perhaps the best skilled person Zimbabwe has. And that's how I'm going to assemble a team that will be Team Zimbabwe, fighting against corruption, maladministration, greed, and sleaze.
As some Zimbabweans are telling me, that the country is sharply divided into two. The incumbent president, so to speak, President Emmerson Mnangagwa, and the main opposition challenger, Mr. Chamisa. You being the third, they are accusing you of being a spoiler, being propagated by the system, so you snatch away some vote from the opposition so President Mnangagwa can win. Realistically, what do you think your chances are to become the next president of the Republic of Zimbabwe?
I'll be the next leader of Zimbabwe come the 23rd of August. I'll be the leader of the country, and I did not enter this race to snatch anyone's voters. If that happens, then tough luck. Those voters never belong to the one who might be dreaming that those voters are his or her. I am coming to this race with a very clear political agenda, a very clear economic program, and a very clear understanding of the issues at stake. The key issue at stake is about to bring unity, focus on our people and development. As it stands right now, this binary is not working. This toxicity is not working. We are sick and tired of him and her, me and you. We want to build a country where we, all as Zimbabweans, have equal access to opportunities, can be able to participate in their fields of endeavor without victimization.
Tyson Savior Kasukuwere is a presidential candidate and a former minister in the governing ZANU-PF. He spoke with me from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare. Listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the leader of the opposition party, Build One South Africa, is calling on the governing African National Congress, or ANC, to pressure Zimbabwe to ensure the coming elections are transparent and credible. Musi Maimane also says bad policies carried out by Zimbabwe's ruling party is to blame for what he says is the mass exodus of citizens to neighboring countries such as South Africa. Maimane asks that the ANC has not done enough to pressure the administration in Harare to create a level playing field to ensure credible elections. His remarks come after opposition groups expressed concern about intimidation and harassment of their voters in the run-up to the August polls. Maimane tells me that he believes the opposition could defeat the ZANU-PF in peaceful and transparent elections.
Kenyans have a famous saying that says, at first we must be liberated, and then we must liberate ourselves from the liberators. The truth of the matter is that ZANU-PF are trading in a coalition with the ANC as former liberators, and ZANU-PF now have become oppressors of the people of Zimbabwe. This is evidenced by the fact that it is clear that elections are unfree and fair. It is clear that activists are being locked up. It is clear that there's no such thing as free media in Zimbabwe. And South Africa with its ally of the ANC is sitting back observing the situation take place. So for us, as Build One South Africa, I stand strongly to say, if we want a stable SADC region that involves all the countries, we need to ensure that the people of Zimbabwe's will of electing a democratic government that is actually upholding of the rule of law, South Africa must stand and make sure we are intervening in that situation to ensure that dictators like Mnangagwa are removed. Because if we fail to do that, we are going to end up in a situation where South Africa and other African countries, Zambia, etc., have to now be spectators to Zimbabweans fleeing dictators to come into their own countries, often against their will. And often, as I have hosted many Zimbabwean activists in South Africa, where people are being chased out of their countries for fear of being killed.
Musi, so what specifically do you think ZANU-PF can do now in the run-up to the election to ensure that the elections are free, fair, transparent, and credible, and that will reflect the will of the people?
What I'm simply asking for is that let's allow for free political activity. No one should be arrested because they take a view against the government. We must scrap this new law that they have passed that ensures that, in fact, anyone cannot be critical of the government. We must furthermore call for the international community, where when we look at the nature of Zimbabwe, that an international election commission must be put there and must be independent to make sure best practices are on the table. Free speech must be upheld, and the army must pledge not to be involved in the elections. The army has got nothing to do with the security of elections. I will equally so be engaging, as we've noticed, even on minor things like increasing of fees for candidates, etc., so as to eliminate opposition, must be scrapped so that we can ensure that all the playing rules are the same for every candidate in Zimbabwe.
Musi, what do you say to supporters of the ANC who are of the view that the ANC can only advise ZANU-PF and cannot put pressure on them? Otherwise, it would be deemed as interfering in the internal dynamics of Zimbabwe, as well as undermining its territorial integrity, or for that matter, interfering in the sovereignty issues of Zimbabwe.
The nature of the problem is such that if it does not, we have gone through the idea of quiet diplomacy under President Mbeki. And all that ended up happening is porous borders between South Africa and Zimbabwe. And it is having challenges where Zimbabweans are now living in South Africa away from home for fear of these things. And economy is collapsing. And we cannot even begin to make an argument about immigration and immigration laws in South Africa because of the situation in Zimbabwe. If you want to deal with immigration, start in Zimbabwe. And therefore, what has become a Zimbabwean problem is fast becoming a South African crisis. So I maintain the view, even to ANC supporters, that we tried quiet diplomacy before, it has not worked. Now it is time for us to intervene. It's not even a function of undermining sovereignty. It's about upholding international law and making sure that Africa rids itself of dictators if we're going to be a continent of democrats.
Musi, what are your expectations for the upcoming elections in Zimbabwe?
No, I do not expect them at the current conditions. I can see all the trickery has begun. I don't expect them to be free and fair. That's why I'm putting up this challenge and this fight. And I'm urging all law-abiding citizens of the continent and citizens who want democracy to work, to keep a strong eye on Zimbabwe, make sure elections are free and fair. I maintain that in a free and a fair election, ZANU-PF would not win that election.
Musi Maimane leads the Build One South Africa opposition party. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. Rights Watch has welcomed as good news a UK court decision stating that the government's Rwanda policy is illegal. In its ruling, the Court of Appeal said plans by the administration to send asylum seekers to Rwanda could violate their human rights. The government says it will contest the decision. But human rights groups are hailing the ruling. This, as government critics say, the policy is unethical and an affront to fairness. They also accuse the Rwandan government of repressing opponents, accusations the government routinely denies. Louise Mudge is the Central Africa Director at Human Rights Watch. He tells me that the ruling should encourage the UK government to abandon the policy.
We at Human Rights Watch, we have not been quiet about our position with regards to this plan by the UK government to try to escape its obligations in providing asylum to asylum seekers and also in sending people who are seeking asylum in the UK to a third country that fundamentally doesn't respect broad issues with regards to human rights. And so we think this is good news in the UK, which is a country that has really been in some ways not experiencing many bright spots with regards to its human rights track record. And this also, I think this is the UK court sending a clear and strong message that despite the fact that this Tory government and the government of Rwanda really wanted to present Rwanda as a rights-respecting country, that the facts simply don't match up with that narrative. Rwanda is a country where it is very, very dangerous to be against the political powers of the Rwanda Patriotic Front, the party in power. And so it sends a strong message, in our opinion, and it is a good day.
The UK government said it will appeal against the ruling. What are your expectations for or hopes following the human rights strong opposition to this asylum-seeking policy by the UK government?
Well, the judiciary in the UK is not like the judiciary in Rwanda in so much as that it remains independent. And so we are cautiously optimistic that this ruling will stand because on the face of it, this should not be a legal and lawful system. And the UK courts have acknowledged that. So we expect this ruling to stand.
Well, some people are suggesting that this is a vindication of the importance of the rule of law and basic fairness. Is that the stance of your organization?
Yeah, we at Human Rights Watch absolutely see this as the vindication of rule of law. The fact is that sometimes when you have a country like Rwanda where the rule of law is not respected and where the judiciary is not independent, sometimes you need a judiciary in a different country, such as the United Kingdom in this instance, to really make that assertion that this is a context, this immoral and illegal deal that the Tories were trying to push through was being done in a context in which there is judicial oversight. And the UK courts have spoken, and they have said that this is not legal.
The Prime Minister said he fundamentally disagrees with the ruling, although the Court of Appeal ruled that Rwanda had not provided enough safeguards to provide it a safe third country. What are your thoughts?
Well, the UK Prime Minister can say whatever he wants. I mean, of course he's going to say that because this was his policy. This was the policy of his Tory party. Him saying that still doesn't make this a legitimate, a moral and a fair and valid policy. This policy from the very first day it was released under Boris Johnson, this policy has been a complete disaster. And I really would, it's not my job to be a political consultant, but if I were one, I would advise the UK Prime Minister to abandon this policy because it is not going to move forward as the UK courts have so demonstrated.
Looking at this court case and the ruling, what happens if it's abandoned?
What's important to note here is that not one person was actually sent under this UK deal. Not one person was sent to Rwanda. So this UK court decision has come in time to prevent people who are seeking asylum in the United Kingdom, who have every right to seek asylum and to have their arbitration heard for their asylum case in the United Kingdom, the country which they desire to get to. Those people will have those cases and those arbitrations happen in the UK, which is where it should be happening. So What we think will happen is the UK Tory party will come to its senses, will realize that this was a disaster from the beginning, will abandon this amoral and illegal plan, and will actually focus on giving asylum seekers their due process basic rights and allowing them to seek asylum in the UK and judge those asylum claims on a case-by-case basis, which, by the way, will also save the British taxpayers a lot of money. This UK deal with Rwanda was not only a boondoggle in the legal sense, but it was a boondoggle in the financial sense.
Louise Mudge is the Central Africa Director at Human Rights Watch. He spoke with me from the Chadian capital in N'Djamena. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Africa on the English service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C.
Every
From the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it.
Tell your friends about VOA Africa, music, sports, and news.
Nightland Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightland team, including producer Mike Hobbe, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, he who talks too much ends up talking nonsense. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.